Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, good morning, everybody. And happy Mother's Day to roughly half of you.
We went in February.
So, yeah, roughly half, any half, right? I have papers to pass out first. This is, if you've got something that's on your mind for next fall, write it down on here and hand that back to me. So then I'll choose the things I feel like I can most reasonably lead us in next fall, or find folks to lead us in next fall. So, any topics that are on your mind?
Well, for one, I would like to thank you for being willing to serve again in the fall. Tip of the hat. Very much appreciated that you devote your time for this group.
I'm glad that I can.
Yes, much appreciated.
So, you're welcome. Thank you all for being here week after week. We are on week 3 out of 4 talking about climate change. So last week we had sort of a compressed meeting because we were on the wrong end of the building, so we started late, and then I had to make sure I left right on time rather than being able to squeeze and make William just keep playing Prelude until I show up. So last week we covered a little bit of, okay, climate change, what do we really know and how do we know it? So I want to first, before we turn to this week, okay, what do we do? I want to invite any responses to or questions about last week before we turn to this week's topic. Anything that's just been like nagging at you since we met last week?
I thought it was pretty conclusive and well-rounded, big body of information about climate change. And I tried to look at the evening news with those kinds of, that kind of perspective. And my gosh, if you didn't for some reason believe it, you would just see half the news is, you know, horrible things happening to our climate, unusual things.
You know,
it's happening before our eyes.
In the climate change things, there's things that you don't even think about. And I found articles recently. They were talking about a lot of nuclear power plants were built in the 70s, 30, 40 years ago. And they were hardened for that weather events of that time. Now they're starting to wonder if maybe with the global climate change, are they hardened enough, basically? Because the last thing you want to do is lose a nuclear power plant. You can cross off a state, basically. And things like that start creeping into the thought process of what they have to do to start getting ready for the change. And the EPA is kind of dragging their feet because they don't really want to spend the money. But I was working for a company that supplied product to Three Mile Island at the time Three Mile Island imploded, and believe me, it can be serious, that kind of stuff. You just, and like with Japan, what happened there, the tsunami, it just shut them down because they weren't ready for it.
Right. So, and the last reactor, or I think last one reactor at Three Mile Island is actually going to shut down later this year. The company that owns it has made the decision to shut it down. So I just recently did a little reading about Three Mile Island again in the article that talked about this other reactor. The one that melted down has never reopened.
What year was that? I was trying to
70.
Yeah.
70, what, that was about 2 years, I was at Marley.
Ryan was born in 78.
I was at Marley, it was about 78-ish.
Yeah. So that was a mechanical failure in the cooling system. And so there was a, you know, things happened. It was mechanical. Actually, in the supplementary watching for this week, if you wanted to do the spend the extra 17 minutes learning about sort of what do we need to do, that very point was made about the way that many of our sort of industrial systems and infrastructure systems are sort of built for a certain climate and for a certain ambient temperature. So, you know, our buildings are built to handle a certain temperature range and keep us comfortable inside. But the, yeah, cooling systems on power plants assume a certain temperature of water as input to that cooling process. So what happens when the water that you're sourcing is warmer than it otherwise would have been? Can the cooling system keep up?
So, and one of the problems, a Japanese problem, is it took out the power to the pumps.
And and the Japanese situation with Fukushima was, of course, an earthquake, not a climate change event.
But it just points out the
right. Exactly. Yeah. So tectonic activity is probably one of the very few processes that's not substantively affected by global climate change. On the other hand, if you have a higher sea level and then hit that with a tsunami, what happens, right? And that's probably a multiplying effect, not an adding effect. So the higher your sea level, the much higher your tsunamis, I would guess. That's, tsunamis are not my area of expertise. Extreme events are getting worse, and we are seeing that playing out in real time. As we learned last week, the sort of the science of attributing any particular extreme weather event to climate change is advancing quite a bit. It depends on climate modeling, sort of running a, you know, running a counter scenario in your climate model to see, okay, if there hadn't been this amount of moisture in the atmosphere, what would that event have looked like as compared to when there is this amount of moisture in the atmosphere? Those sorts of you have to run competing models to see how much of a given event is attributable to climate change. The news is certainly reflecting the effects of climate change as it's already taking place, there's a significant lag between the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere and the effects of that carbon dioxide in terms of temperature change. So, other responses.
In the last several days, I've kind of heard or been involved with a couple of things that I'm not sure they were talking about, and maybe other people who are more into this can tell me, but how you can put carbon back in the soil. And one of the comments that was made, and I thought it made a lot of sense, is how we should look at how to work with nature as opposed to against it. One of the things in the paper this morning was talking about how U of I and Louisiana State, I think it is, are working together to look at the flooding of the Mississippi and how maybe we should be moving people out of the floodplain instead of allowing them to be right on the river and constantly fixing things up. Mm-hmm. So, and we had a lady speaker yesterday who was talking about the prairies and how we have worked totally against nature so that all of the, what used to be prairie grasses and things that were so deep rooted would retain some of the water, mm-hmm. and it would go down in, and now it just runs off. And then when it runs off with all of the pesticides, et cetera, now we've contaminated our waters. So one thing leads to another. You're gonna have to back up enough to be able to figure out what it is that we can do and still take care of the things, the damage we've done.
Right.
And the comments that I've heard from people that are kind of anti is, well, that's going to cost too much. I think it's going to cost a whole lot more if we don't do something.
And the problem becomes, you know, if I'm a farmer, first thing I want to do is try and get as much corn in the ground as I can. I'll plow right up to whatever I can to expand that acreage. And so they don't have the
wetlands
or the grass
to
absorb it.
Exactly.
And they're having another problem is that, from what I've read somewhere, about the aquifers under Iowa are about half full at this point because the water's running off so fast, it's not seeping down into the aquifers.
Right. So there's a
there's all sorts of issues.
Yeah. So there's several different effects going on there, including the lack of deep rooted plants creating more runoff. We're getting probably about the same amount of rain, but it's happening in fewer events. So when it rains hard. Right. We had that old saying, right? It never rains, but it pours. It's increasingly true. And a really extreme rainfall event turns into a flash flood, not into nice, lovely, saturated soil. The soil can be saturated by a concentration of events, and then you've got a different set of problems. But the more quickly you rain on soil, the more runoff you get, as opposed to the more soaking in and replenishing that aquifer, then more of the other sort of runoff of chemicals, the flooding.
Well, and one of the other comments that the lady made was what used to be even prairie or cornfields are now housing. So now a lot of the water is running off of concrete.
Right.
So it can't even really go into anything.
Right. So there's a huge network of issues there. And there's, as Kent mentions, then there's the question of what does it cost? Not just what does it cost to do the direct sort of mitigation, but what does it cost in terms of changing a system, you know, changing the economics of farming, so that it's not, so in the incentives change away from this planting, you know, from one road to the other road, filling as much of that space as you possibly can with a cash crop. How do we change that structure as well, Sue?
Well, I just noticed, you know, when I've driven down to Fontenelle and Greenfield and that, and a lot of the farmers, like Ken said, are planting as much as they can. They're planting over the draws, the natural ditches, that they're not leaving those.
Yeah.
Some of them, some farmers are not. They're just planting crops there, which are, that's the natural runoff spot.
And right.
They aren't leaving the draws where they need to be.
Right.
They've always been.
Right.
And as an individual farmer, when I'm only getting X number of dollars for bushel of wheat, I'm going to do the same thing with our corn. Right.
Right. Yeah. So these incentives that are stacked against any individual farmer, against any individual homeowner, against any individual, you know, sort of at the municipality level, we start to have some ability to sort of change those incentives. But there's a swimming upstream piece of the sort of the economics of this. But Jean is also right. Economists are looking at the overall effect of climate change on national and even global economic life. So productivity and costs of mitigation. The hotter it is, the less productive many parts of the world become. The upper Midwest actually probably gets a little bit more productive as the weather warms up, so long as we have moisture. Once we dry out, our productivity goes down as well. So there's this other set of costs, and so part of the question is how do we do a cost-benefit analysis at that scale in a way that we can actually respond to locally. I'm going to talk about, or I'm not going to talk about, Vicky Arroyo is going to talk about local responses today. Next week, we're going to get some conversation about, okay, is there a way to actually pull, the word he's going to use is draw down. Is there a way to draw down the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at a larger scale? So we're going to have some really big initiatives and solutions next week. We're going to have some really local solutions, but adaptations. We're at the place where we really need to be adapting to climate change as a thing that's already happening. And to adapt to climate change in a way that doesn't make climate change worse, right? Because we could adapt locally by outsourcing all of our emissions and ultimately make things worse, even though our air conditioning keeps functioning. Or we can talk about how do we adapt locally in a way that is a piece of a larger response to climate change. Gene mentioned soil. There's some, it's not even new research, it's not like new knowledge, but it's a new reminder for us that that soil actually is alive. If it's going to grow anything, it's got to be alive, or you've got to put stuff on it that lets your plants grow, right? But you know, a good, healthy, biologically active soil is helping to pull carbon out of the atmosphere or keep carbon in the soil. So that lovely black dirt in Iowa, right? It's black because it's full of carbon. And so the blacker we can get the soil, the better the whole world is, right? So that's one of those places where even like your personal lawn and landscaping choices have bearing on global climate change, and not just what kind of emissions does your lawnmower put out, although lawnmowers are really terribly polluting per cubic centimeter. We're going to look at some local adaptations here to global climate change. So how do human environments reorganize in response to climate change?
This is the skyline of my hometown, New Orleans. It was a great place to grow up, but it's one of the most vulnerable spots in the world. Half the city is already below sea level. In 2005, the world watched as New Orleans and the Gulf Coast were devastated by Hurricane Katrina. 1,836 people died. Nearly 300,000 homes were lost. These are my mother's at the top, although that's not her car. It was carried there by floodwaters up to the roof. And that's my sister's below. Fortunately, they and other family members got out in time, but they lost their homes, and as you can see, just about everything in them. Other parts of the world have been hit by storms in even more devastating ways. In 2008, Cyclone Nargis and its aftermath killed 138,000 in Myanmar. Climate change is affecting our homes, our communities, our way of life. We should be preparing at every scale and at every opportunity. This talk is about being prepared for and resilient to the changes that are coming and that will affect our homes and our collective home, the Earth. The changes in these times won't affect us all equally. There are important distributional consequences, and they're not what you always might think. In New Orleans, the elderly and female-headed households were among the most vulnerable. For those in vulnerable low-lying nations, how do you put a dollar value on losing your country where your ancestors are buried? And where will your people go? And how will they cope in a foreign land? Will there be tensions over immigration or conflicts over competition for limited resources? It's already fueled conflicts in Chad and Darfur. Like it or not, ready or not, this is our future. Sure, some are looking for opportunities in this new world. That's the Russians planting a flag on the ocean bottom to stake a claim for minerals under the receding Arctic sea ice. But while there might be some short-term individual winners, our collective losses will far outweigh them. Look no further than the insurance industry as they struggle to cope with mounting catastrophic losses from extreme weather events. The military gets it. They call climate change a threat multiplier that could harm stability and security, while governments around the world are evaluating how to respond. So what can we do? How can we prepare and adapt? I'd like to share three sets of examples, starting with adapting to violent storms and floods. In New Orleans, the I-10 twin spans, with sections knocked out in Katrina, have been rebuilt 21 feet higher to allow for greater storm surge. And these raised and energy-efficient homes were developed by Brad Pitt and Make It Right for the hard-hit Ninth Ward. The devastated church my mom attends has been not only rebuilt higher, it's poised to become the first Energy Star church in the country. They're selling electricity back to the grid thanks to solar panels, reflective paint, and more. Their March electricity bill was only $48. Now, these are examples of New Orleans rebuilding in this way, but better if others act proactively with these changes in mind. For example, in Galveston, here's a resilient home that survived Hurricane Ike when others on neighboring lots clearly did not. And around the world, satellites and warning systems are saving lives in flood-prone areas such as Bangladesh. But as important as technology and infrastructure are, perhaps the human element is even more critical. We need better planning and systems for evacuation. We need to better understand how people make decisions in times of crisis and why. While it's true that many who died in Katrina did not have access to transportation, others who did refused to leave as the storm approached, often because available transportation and shelters refused to allow them to take their pets. Imagine leaving behind your own pet in an evacuation or a rescue. Fortunately, in 2006, Congress passed the Pet Evacuation and Transportation Standards Act. It spells pets to change that. Second, preparing for heat and drought. Farmers are facing challenges of drought from Asia to Africa, from Australia to Oklahoma, while heat waves linked with climate change have killed tens of thousands of people in Western Europe in 2003 and again in Russia in 2010. In Ethiopia, 70%, that's 70% of the population, depends on rainfall for its livelihood. Oxfam and Swiss Re, together with Rockefeller Foundation, are helping farmers like this one build hillside terraces and find other ways to conserve water. But they're also providing for insurance when the droughts do come. The stability this provides is giving the farmers the confidence to invest. It's giving them access to affordable credit. It's allowing them to become more productive so that they can afford their own insurance over time without assistance. It's a virtuous cycle and one that could be replicated throughout the developing world. After a lethal 1995 heat wave turned refrigerator trucks from the popular Taste of Chicago festival into makeshift morgues, Chicago became a recognized leader, tamping down on the urban heat island impact through opening cooling centers, outreach to vulnerable neighborhoods, planting trees, creating cool white or vegetated green roofs. This is City Hall's green roof next to Cook County's roof, which is 77 degrees Fahrenheit hotter at the surface. Washington, D.C., last year, actually led the nation in new green roofs installed. And they're funding this in part thanks to a 5-cent tax on plastic bags. They're splitting the cost of installing these green roofs with home and building owners. The roofs not only temper urban heat island impact, but they save energy and therefore money, the emissions that cause climate change, and they also reduce stormwater runoff. So some solutions to heat can provide for win-win-wins. Third, adapting to rising seas. Sea level rise threatens coastal ecosystems, agriculture, even major cities. This is what 1 to 2 meters of sea level rise looks like in the Mekong Delta. That's where half of Vietnam's rice is grown. Infrastructure is going to be affected. Airports around the world are located on the coast. It makes sense, right? There's open space. The planes can take off and land without worrying about creating noise or avoiding tall buildings. Here's just one example, San Francisco Airport, with 16 inches or more of flooding. Imagine the staggering cost of protecting this vital infrastructure with levees. But there might be some changes in store that you might not imagine. For example, planes require more runway for takeoff because the heated, less dense air provides for less lift. San Francisco is also spending $40 million to rethink and redesign its water and sewage treatment, as water outfall pipes like this one can be flooded with seawater, causing backups at the plant, harming the bacteria that are needed to treat the waste. So these outfall pipes have been retrofitted to shut seawater off from entering the system. Beyond these technical solutions, our work at the Georgetown Climate Center with communities encourages them to look at what existing legal and policy tools are available and to consider how they can accommodate change. For example, in land use, which areas do you want to protect through adding a seawall, for example, alter by raising buildings, or retreat from to allow the migration of important natural systems, such as wetlands or beaches? Other examples to consider. In the UK, the Thames Barrier protects London from storm surge. The Asian City's Climate Resilience Network is restoring vital ecosystems like forest mangroves. These are not only important ecosystems in their own right, but they also serve as a buffer to protect inland communities. New York City is incredibly vulnerable to storms, as you can see from this clever sign, and to sea level rise and to storm surge, as you can see from the subway flooding. But back above ground, these raised ventilation grates for the subway system show that solutions can be both functional and attractive. In fact, in New York, San Francisco, and London, designers have envisioned ways to better integrate the natural and built environments with climate change in mind. I think these are inspiring examples of what's possible when we feel empowered to plan for a world that will be different. But now, a word of caution. Adaptation is too important to be left to the experts. Why? Well, there are no experts. We're entering uncharted territory, and yet our expertise and our systems are based on the past. Stationarity is the notion that we can anticipate the future based on the past and plan accordingly. And this principle governs much of our engineering, our design of critical infrastructure, city water systems, building codes, even water rights and other legal precedents. But we can simply no longer rely on established norms. We're operating outside the bounds of CO2 concentrations that this planet has seen for hundreds of thousands of years. The larger point I'm trying to make is this. It's up to us to look at our homes and our communities, our vulnerabilities and our exposures to risk, and to find ways to not just survive, but to thrive. And it's up to us to plan and to prepare and to call on our government leaders and require them to do the same, even while they address the underlying causes of climate change. There are no quick fixes. There are no one-size-fits-all solutions. We're all learning by doing. But the operative word is doing. Thank you.
I neglected to date this particular talk, which I mentioned has been important as we deal with climate change because the science is changing rapidly and the consequences are unfolding rapidly. This was in June of 2012, so 7 years ago next month. Vicky Arroyo was talking about the distributional consequences. I think that's important for us to bear in mind that that the effects of climate change are going to hit some populations more than others and more harshly than others. She focused us on three areas for adaptation. Remember, we'll talk about trying to reverse climate change next week with actually some more recent talks about that. But in terms of adapting, she talks about human systems, so things like understanding how people make decisions of when and how to evacuate, understanding where people are, and how we as government structures, as social structures, as individual structures can respond. She talked about drought resilience, the sort of the primary sort of climate shift around the world is going to be an increase in drought. There will be places where there will be increases in rainfall instead, but generally we're going to see a lot more drought around the world. Rising sea levels. What do we do in response to rising sea levels? Which is a lot like the question of what do we do in response to a river basin that floods? Do we keep habitation, farming, so forth in that floodplain, in that sea floodplain as we start to experience those more? And how do we make those decisions? That's where the third point comes back, I think, to that distributional question. If we're making decisions about what areas do we protect against rising sea levels, what areas do we accommodate rising sea levels, what areas do we abandon to rising sea levels, and sort of restore to a non-human natural process that that might actually help the rest. Boy, whom do we choose to displace in that, right? So that was 7 years ago. We have continued to see how the effects of climate change are really unpredictable. So the climate is a really complicated system. Chaotic is the proper word for how all of these forces work together to create any individual weather event and even any individual year's pattern of weather. Chaotic refers to a system where a very small change in the inputs results in a very large change in the outputs. As the system continues to change, these output changes, the effects of weather are going to be really significant, and some catastrophic changes could come. For instance, as an ice sheet destabilizes, then all of a sudden we have these very big effects. So that's what Vicky Arroyo wants us to prepare for. She mentioned really great ideas like green roofs that reduce that urban heat island effect. Great ideas like restoring floodplains so that the floods have somewhere to go rather than just being shunted downstream or overtopping our subway vents. We don't have subway vents in Des Moines, but some of those particular scenarios. Now, what risks are present as we work to adapt to climate change? So we're up against climate change on the one side. On the other side, what are we also up against? What do we want to try to avoid as we adapt to climate change?
One thing I saw in the film, making sure your technology does get you where you want to go. She referred to Brad Pitt.
Right.
They built flat roofs on those houses.
Mm-hmm.
And in New Orleans, that's kind of a no-no. And they had mildew problems in those particular units. Because it kind of accumulates up there from the rain that they get. So make sure your technology is going to work. Other things that I've read about, they got into an argument here with Mid-America versus individuals net metering.
Mm-hmm.
And I really couldn't figure out what would be the right answer, because in Costa Rica, Puerto Rico, the utility companies are bad enough that everyone was going to solar panels,
mm-hmm.
which means the ones that were still on the grid had to pay more per unit of that. So it was kind of destroying the utility grid system for individual units.
Right.
So I never could quite figure out another part that played, did that work? Another part that played with solar panels in California, they are leasing them, and they're putting on the roofs,
mm-hmm.
and they can't afford to buy them. So when a person goes to sell the house, the solar panel is not really part of the house, so how do they get rid of the mm-hmm. solar panels? And you have to make a decision who takes over think about these
small
little details that play into that. Yeah, everyone puts a solar panel up there, but if it's not a part of the house,
right?
Do you buy it?
Right. Do you buy it? Do you buy the lease? What do you do?
Does the guy that had the house previously get stuck with the lease?
Right. So there are
all these little things that play out in the
details. And these are all sort of infrastructure type problems, right?
Yeah.
You talk about the question of, you know, who should pay for the electrical grid. Are people with solar panels on their roofs paying enough for the electrical grid?
Because there are wires and cables on it.
Right.
Activity-based costing.
Right. There's a that's actually pretty comparable, I think, to the question of who pays for the roads, right? So this is both energy efficient moves that have had a at least arguably, I'm not going to resolve that argument, right? Whether people are in fact paying fairly for it or whatever, but the argument is that you drive a hybrid or electric car and you're not burning enough gas to pay enough gasoline tax to pay for the road, right?
Yeah.
Or you have a solar panel on your roof and you're not paying enough for your electricity to pay for the electrical grid that supplies the backup electricity, right? So there are these questions of how do we fund infrastructure when infrastructure usage, or I'm sorry, when infrastructure funding is based on a usage tax that assumes a certain level of efficiency, right? It assumes a certain level of efficiency of the fuel that you need in order to tax that and fund the infrastructure with it. So how do we do that? And how do we do that in a way that's equitable, right?
That's also trying to solve the problem based on what used to be. When she was talking about
it's
that.
A stationarity problem, isn't it? Yeah.
Instead of being able to go forward with, okay, now what?
Right.
Now how do we handle it?
Right. So and that's one of those places where do we try to preserve the world that was, or do we find a new way to accomplish the same end? Like we need roads, right? In order to get ambulances down them. That's always sort of my thought about, there's the idea of just, a usage fee on roads, tolls or whatever, right? Which is great until you need an ambulance, right? And I think ambulance service needs to be regardless of whether you have paid your usage fee on the road. Or pay for use of the electrical grid, which is fine unless the one good is to not need the electrical grid, and the other good is to have the electrical grid there in case you need it, right? So how do we balance these things? And how do we do that in a way that doesn't try to preserve a world that was, but rather moves into the world that says we're going to have to, for instance, reduce gasoline consumption. There is the two biggest factors in fossil fuel emissions or carbon emissions generally is transportation and food. So meat production in particular, beef production if you want to get really specific. So what do we do? You're going to disrupt an economy. Right, and so how do we preserve the goods that we have on one hand, the human goods, while also dealing with the underlying structural problems?
I think one of the biggest problems you have is trying to get an attitude change. In that, the last election specifically. Was a lot of it, well, it's a hoax, let's go back to the way things were, to the mythology of the 50s, whatever years, and at the same time get real about the other. Because when that was suggested, and that it's a very, to me, the Green New Deal thing is really radical, but I think you need to look at some of the other things where the reaction was, that's going to cost too much money, we can't fly airplanes and we can't eat any hamburgers. So you're going to have to come up with some way that you get to people and say, I don't know how you change that attitude, that this is something you really need to look at, not just today.
Right, and I want to acknowledge that played out in a very particular way in the 2016 election, and the way that the question of whether we have any good science around climate change, the way that question has been politicized, that is really, really problematic. That it is somehow a politically charged statement to say 97% of reputable climate scientists in the world are in agreement that global climate change is happening, global warming is happening, and it is caused predominantly by human activity. The idea that 97% of scientists would agree on anything, where science is built around debating, right? It's built around marshaling evidence around ideas and testing hypotheses against, well, what if that's not the case? So it is settled science. The idea that that's somehow a political statement is a fantastic problem. But the idea that well, it would cost too much, it's too hard, we can't do it, right? That idea is way older than 2016. The idea that, well, there's no way that we can meet this change, or there's no way that we can ask people not to fly around the world just because they felt like it, right? That idea that we somehow can't solve this problem, and that we can't bring all of our resources to bear, that idea has been around for a very long time. We mentioned the Dust Bowl last week, right? Now, the Dust Bowl was a more local climate change. It was a climate change, and has had long-lasting effects on the sort of southern part of the American Midwest, right? So there have been very long-lasting effects of the causes of the Dust Bowl. We sort of walked ourselves into that problem by trying to solve other problems with the solutions that we already had at hand, right? We need to keep growing more, we need to clear more land, it was a lot of the similar thinking that has gotten us here was already getting us in trouble then. And that is, at the end of the day, that's not a partisan question, right? There have been lots of really bad conservative ideas around the climate. There have been lots of really bad liberal ideas around the climate. And there have probably been good ideas on both sides if we could actually agree that there's science here and we can start to wrestle with how do we do this. Last week's video was also 2012. There was conversation then, this has shifted in a big way, but there was conversation, sort of the structural recommendation that Dr. Hansen suggested last week was a global, or at least national, price on carbon consumption that was, you collect that at the energy company level, and then presumably they pass that cost along to consumers, right? That's what companies do. And then you dividend that back on a per capita basis. But what you're doing is you're creating a market force that allows people to make more sensible decisions about what energy they're going to consume. That's not even on the table anymore, but Dr. Hansen quoted a conservative economist saying, this sounds like a conservative climate plan. So there are ways that, hey, let's make this market-based, probably is a really good choice. There are ways that say, we need governmental action on this, is probably a really good choice. If we say it's got to be one thing or the other thing, we are never going to get anywhere, because locking horns over something is a great way to keep the status quo in place. So this idea that we can't do anything, and that we can't do anything until we're all in agreement about this, is, I think, part of why we're not doing anything. Dr. Arroyo mentioned some examples of specific ways that individuals, groups, municipalities are responding to climate change. Did any of those sound like, hey, that would be a really good idea? I wonder what piece of that I could do.
Well, just a general observation. People that live near the Mississippi or the Missouri, some of them are just willing to know, I'm going to be wiped out every couple of years and I'll just redo it. But then I like on one of these, you know, I'm going to raise the house high enough and sturdy enough that I know the waters are going to come and won't affect me. I'm going to raise that interstate bridge. You know, rather than rebuilding Hamburg, I talked to a guy that lived in Hamburg as a kid. It's nothing new to Hamburg, the Missouri floods, but they don't seem to do anything different. And I'm not sure the Corps of Engineers is their best friend in terms of neglect of levees or not raising them high enough, whatever. But and it's back to that old definition: if you just keep doing what you're doing, why do you expect different results? It's either we either gotta, if we're gonna live in Hamburg, we're gonna have to raise those buildings, or quit living in Hamburg. And if you think you're gonna farm the land by the Missouri, you're gonna know that you're probably gonna be wiped out. I don't know, but it's a real possibility. And if you're a gambler, no help from anybody else. But if you want to go in and gamble on that farmland, have at it. But there's no help. And that's kind of cruel, because I don't have a family farm in that floodplain. Right. So it's easy for me in West Des Moines to talk that way.
Right.
But I really, that stationary word.
Stationary?
Yeah. And the other thing that caught my ear was we have no experts.
Yeah.
Whoa! So who your experts are.
Right.
If they use the economists are real good on explaining the past. They're not good at projecting the future.
Right.
So we may have some people that can explain the past, but if you make your projections, not only in weather, but just say in technology.
Right.
You talk about 7 years, just think what 7 years has done in technology.
Right.
And we can't work, and I'm not a scientist, but you can't work on, you know, that was a 100-year flood. We had another one 8 years later. The weather people, how do you know it was a 100-year flood to begin with?
Right.
It's the old thought.
And then, they have two of them in 8 years. Who's going to have faith in that expert?
And the problem's more complicated with, like, you can build the levees higher at one point. But it pushes the water down.
Yeah. It solves my problem.
So now Missouri's got a bigger issue.
Right. Downstream has the problem.
Right. And that's where it becomes a distributional question too, right? So we can build a levee up here and keep Kent's Field dry at the cost of Warren's Field.
Yeah.
Right? Which is a cost I'm willing to bear because I'm upstream of Kent.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But whom do we ask to bear the costs? And some of these costs are going to be really extreme. You know, there isn't ultimately an economic way to compensate Warren for having to abandon the family farm and ask Kent to abandon the family farm or completely change the way they're farming, at least, to accommodate both of them flood, right? So that neither of them has to flood as badly. But man, I'm about to like start preaching the gospel here, right? Like we are all in this together, right? That this is a question of how do we, as you know, self-centered, sinful people that we are, deal with something that requires us to all share one another's burdens.
Yesterday, when I heard this speaker, she's a master gardener, but she's not a master. She's a master gardener of trying to restore prairie, Iowa prairie. She came from Virginia, where she, I didn't even know they had prairies in Virginia, but evidently they did because she worked on that.
We're a lot
she
smaller.
Said when she got here, she had to learn a whole different science of what kind of plants survive. But anyway, to get to the point, one of the things that she commented on was that one of the ways we can help, for example, for pollination or to keep monarchs and what have you, is if every one of us in our garden would plant an actual prairie plant, mm-hmm. as opposed to the other, or the annuals. And when I have in my house areas of shade, and that's, they do not like the direct, I have no way of getting direct sun. Mm-hmm. And she said there are a number of plants you can use from prairie that did not have it. And there's other plants in the prairie that like to have wet feet and others that like dry feet. And you can just go online and find out the ones. And they are available either online or in some of our houses. So instead of your garden being all of this controlled thing where you throw in an annual, she said the one thing you have to learn is that, first of all, you don't tear up the thing every year. You let it do its thing, and it's kind of a wild-looking thing, but it really can be very beautiful. So just on a very local way,
right.
doing something to be effective, because she said she had one plant that she couldn't figure out. If they call it the butterfly plant because mm-hmm. she didn't know how they found it, but she has just tons of butterflies. So anyway,
right.
just a word.
Right. So that calls for... Thinking back to building the good life for all, when we talked about charity and self-help and cultural formation and advocacy and governmental change, this is a cultural formation question, right? How do I naturalize my yard so that it's a little patch of prairie without ticking off my neighbors, right? Partly, that's a question of my neighbor's attitude. Right? And so there's a cultural formation question there. And if I and my neighbor and the person three doors down all do the same thing, then the neighbors in between are like, oh, that came out pretty after a while. Right? So there's a formation piece of this that affects our individual choices. So next week, we're going to fix climate change.
Completely.
So,
thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.